Our producers here aren't asking much when they settle for just having the process facilitated and their work secured. They just don't want to be held back on account of license, taxes, and insurance. I asked Mr. Livani whether Persian animations were granted license for distribution abroad, or even simply for production and marketing in Iran, because Tondar and Babai seem to have bounded into a dead end with their overseas distribution.
In the area of taxation and insurance, governments usually don't consider animation as their source of income. If we take a look, animation production in countries where they are produced receive subsidies. Unfortunately, we have a lack of regulation in the country, and our animation producers have the right to better acknowledgement.
The Tehran International Animation Festival was established in February 1999, to mention one example. That was aimed to bring together Iranian and foreign animators and animation films and to provide a showcase for unknown potentials in this type of cinema. In 1999, 896 films from Iran and 32 other countries applied for participation in the festival. 488 titles were selected for screening. Lucrative and efficient as animation media is, it has impressed the policymakers. But three major obstacles have been detected that prevent the development of the industry further in Iran. Governmental obstacles, promoters, and structural factors. The solutions are categorized in six basic groups according to our study at hand. Forming a macro-supervisory organization, that is, creating a free market, reforming the educational system, conducting research, and developing accelerators.
In every animation, the more important than the film itself is the merchandising and the ecosystem that you can make around the film, like the games, like the board games, like the toys, and also like the theme parks.
Ms. Babapur gives me a sense of how a statue can be given life.
What happens in the field of animation after we are done modeling, which means we have created a model for the character and it's been texturized or has been colored and received texture details, they are rigged to a bone system. After the bones are rigged, they give it to us, the animators, and after we talk to the director about the scene and what will happen in it, we start to move them, and our movements are based on the 12 basic principles of animation. The 12 principles defined by Disney in the field of animation, like the squash and stretch principle.
Contrary to expectation, our lady animator tells of how it takes half a lifetime to acquire the skill it takes to perfect an animation. And so, many women drop out of work in some 4 years.
Thank God, since this occupation has been established in recent years and more women see how bright the future is for this occupation, women have been involved more than before. On the other hand, studios started giving the stage to women. Before, it was very rare to have a female supervisor in large companies or have women as project leaders and managers. But thank God that this has happened like other industries, and there is now this trust between the studios and women who work with them.
In reference to education, Mr. Khairandish feels there are holes to be filled in course design here and more attention to be paid to absorbing professionals with relevant experience into the workforce. Officially, the best universities in Iran have been ranked based on their research performance in animation. As for the best cities in which to study animation in this country, based on the number of universities and their ranks, those are Tehran, Shirvan, and Isfahan.
Let me use this opportunity to say our universities provide a master's degree in animation, but we don't have a bachelor's degree for animation, which means we're only looking to train directors and critics. While this field needs technical specialists, animators, and modelers. There are so many technical fields that we're ignorant about, and those with a background in illustration and graphic design enter the animation master's program.
Why animation takes professionalism at its best is evident in the complexity of producing an animated piece. The stages of production, the meticulousness and time each stage takes in making your dream a reality with shots specific to each production. I mean your reality as an animator while imagining what the audiences would want. Let's hear it from the professionals who will talk of challenges also along the way.
Yeah, here you are. It's a production studio that they're currently working on the Princess and Dragon web series. And we have some animators. Yeah, they're moving the characters and, you know, there are lots of handles to catching the bones and joints to moving.
How much work is this? How fast can you do something like this?
You know, maybe in 1 month, just 7 minutes. With this big team. In animation department, almost ladies are moving the characters. And also the layout department, that you should talking with him, the supervisor of the layout. So they are layouting and you know, putting the everything foreground, background characters inside the frame.
Sounds a little like layout as a newspaper, but not quite.
Yes, but it is in 3D, you know, atmosphere. And also we have some simulation. For example, they are simulating the liquids inside just one shot. For example, maybe 1 day takes to simulating one shot. For example, this kind of liquids that you can see. Yeah, and technical department, that they are supporting to developing the softwares, to making some UI to you know, increasing the ability of the softwares for our team. And
so they are developing software?
Yes. Yeah.
The others there are moving the pictures?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, and also the lighting department, they are just, you know, putting the proper lights. As I told you, there are physical lights to computing the behavior of the photons of the lights. So it is also a combination of art and technical issues. And finally, they are putting the layers to getting the final image like this. Can you please make it full screen? Yeah, it's like the final image.
After all the work it takes, both producers and politicians would like to see animated productions boost the country's export volume and income. I leave the explanation to Mr. Livani, as he is an in-charge connected to national or governmental TV.
We don't have an eye on the export market right now. The reason is that we haven't been able to supply our domestic demand, and the products that we have already put out are being sold through online platforms and by companies and TV stations.
Iranian animation can be more than Iranian, actually. Testimony to this statement is Iranian animators participating in foreign projects. It's not easy saying bye to all the colorful characters coming to life in the studio and their creators, but that's all we've time for this week. Till then, bye, and thanks from the whole team.
Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, said, "Perform pilgrimage to Karbala, and don't stop doing this, for Karbala has embraced the best son of the prophets."
Limelight. Abramson of the Arms Control Association lamented the lack of political will in the Biden administration to finally close the door on the cluster munition sales and transfers, says Austin Allman Ryder in an article published under the heading, Democrats are squandering their chance to ban cluster bomb sales. Stay tuned for more. When cluster munitions are launched, they disperse into smaller bomblets that rain over the targeted area. While most of those bomblets explode, a considerable portion often do not. Much like landmines, those unexploded bomblets pose risks to civilians and non-military infrastructure for years after a conflict has ended. Under current policy, U.S. transfers of cluster bombs are allowed as long as the bomblets dispersed by the weapons explode at least 99% of the time, and purchasers agree to only use the munitions in non-civilian areas. Experts told Intercept that those restrictions have made a considerable difference to U.S. complicity in the ongoing use of cluster bombs, but fall far short of bringing the country in line with international standards. Over 100 countries have joined the Convention on Cluster Munitions, which bans the use and sale of the weapons outright. When that treaty was negotiated between 2007 and 2008, the U.S. did not participate, even as an observer. But the international pressure helped set the stage for the current restrictions. According to Jeff Abramson, a senior fellow at the Arms Control Association, today's restrictions have led to a massive depletion of the U.S. arsenal of cluster munitions over time. While sales of the munitions remain legal, the high standard on unexploded bomblets has increased the weapons' cost and lessened their desirability. As a result, he told Intercept, at this point, the U.S. is not really selling, transferring, or using cluster munitions. Rather than building on the reduction and progressing to an elimination, the ongoing reluctance to ban the weapons outright opens the door for future sales, Abrams warned. It also harms the U.S. ability to apply political pressure on governments that continue to use these weapons. The United States is weakened in its condemnation of countries by having poor policy and dangerous policy around cluster munitions, Abrams pointed out. The Bush-era policy was resuscitated following a brief regression in the early years of the Trump administration, but its inclusion this time around represents a surprising missed opportunity. Lee has been one of the only members of Congress to advocate consistently to rein in the U.S. war machine. As the Armed Services Committees and Appropriations Defense Subcommittees in both chambers have predictably failed to make headway on the issue, Lee's current powerful seat puts her in a unique and fleeting position to do so. By custom, appropriations bills originate in the House, so Lee's subcommittee is responsible for creating the starting position for negotiations. Should Democrats lose control over one or both chambers of Congress in November, as appears increasingly probable, Lee will likely be demoted to ranking member, and the party will lose its advantage in driving policy. The SFOPS bill includes long-standing language limiting the sale and availability of cluster munitions, including to ensure that concerns regarding unexploded ordnance and use against civilians are addressed. Arms sales are traditionally not in the committee's jurisdiction, but this provision was put in place to protect civilians against unexploded ordnance. A representative for Lee's office wrote in a statement to The Intercept, "Without the SFOPS language, there would not be any limitation on the provision of this equipment. However, the authorization of equipment provided overseas is a larger discussion with other stakeholders. Consistent with Chairwoman Lee's longstanding position of the use of such weapons, we continue to monitor closely U.S. government use of these exceptions." Eric Sperling, the executive director of Just Foreign Policy and a former House staffer who worked on the issue, expressed surprise at the work produced by Lee's subcommittee. "She's always been a strong opponent of cluster bombs," he told Intercept. "So I'm surprised to hear that she or her team would want to keep an explicit exemption to allow the U.S. to transfer them in her own will." On the Senate side, where the filibuster enables Republicans to wield some leverage over the Congress, the corresponding subcommittee is chaired by Senator Chris Coons, a close ally of the Biden administration who has a history of deference to the demands of the Pentagon and the U.S. State Department. But the larger Appropriations Committee is chaired by Senator Patrick Leahy, who has a long history of advocacy against cluster munitions and landmines. Tim Racer, an advisor to Leahy and the Senate Appropriations Committee, told Intercept that the Vermont Democrat maintains his unconditional opposition to the munitions. But Racer indicated that the U.S. Defense Department has opposed giving up the weapons, and the Pentagon opposition, coupled with the narrow divide in both chambers of Congress, currently makes more aggressive policy changes impossible. Abramson of the Arms Control Association lamented the lack of political will in the Biden administration to finally close the door on cluster munition sales and transfers.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
The U.S. military sector is struggling to recruit more personnel as the nation's youth are losing interest in joining the military. As a result, armed forces are experiencing large shortfalls in enlistments for various posts. Figures are representing a lack of enthusiasm among job seekers to join the Army, and it's never been this low since the time after the U.S. war in Vietnam back in 1975. However, the issue is not just related to a shortage of interest, as less than a quarter of young American adults are actually physically fit, and many others have criminal records disqualifying them to be enlisted.
U.S. military shortfalls.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in today's episode, we'll focus on the U.S. military sector and its shortfalls in enlistment. Now, with interest to join the Army dwindling throughout the nation, U.S. Defense is trying hard to create incentives to hire staff necessary for its many operations. In today's show, we'll be joined by Jeremy Kuzmarov, managing editor at Covert Action magazine Tulsa. And later in the program, we'll have Susan Banaszewski, activist at the Center for Political Innovation and member of the Minneapolis Anti-War Committee from Minnesota. Please stay with us.
The U.S. military forces have a large presence across the globe, considering U.S. adventurism worldwide. From the Middle East to South China Sea and Eastern Europe, American forces are present to support allies, take on Chinese and Russian spheres of influence, and act like the so-called leader of the free world.
In fact, according to official estimates, between 160,000 to 180,000 of American active duty personnel are stationed outside the United States and its territories to pursue the U.S. global agenda. After all, a lot of forces are needed to fill the roughly 750 U.S. foreign military bases, which spread across 80 countries. So what is the root cause of the lack of interest today among American youths in pursuing a career in the U.S. military?
I think the reason is because the U.S. has looked bad on the world stage in recent military interventions. You know, they invaded Iraq. The war was based on lies. It caused, you know, catastrophe for the Iraqi people. It was not a source of pride for the American people. Similarly, in Afghanistan, the U.S. fought there for 20 years, and ultimately the Taliban took over. And then there are these smaller scale military interventions like in Libya and Syria that have caused just more chaos and disaster for those countries and have not really yielded any success for the United States. And again, the motive is probably just crass economic materialism. So, I mean, why would a young person want to join the military if they're going to be sent into war, you know, miles and miles for their home? That's not for self-defense. That's based on lies. That's for the greed of oil companies.
Now, multiple U.S. military and defense officials have recently come forward to leak the news. Every branch of the American military is struggling to meet its fiscal year 2022 recruiting goals. U.S. media investigations also corroborate statements, as there is a record low percentage of young Americans eligible to serve or willing to consider it.
Well, I think Americans are ingrained from a young age, you know, to worship the flag, and you know, they say the Pledge of Allegiance in school, and they're kind of conditioned to be very patriotic. And I mean, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, there are, you know, positive virtues of the United States. The U.S. Constitution has some good principles, including things like freedom of speech, freedom of religion. But I think, again, increasingly Americans are weary of the excessive military spending and the, you know, these foreign adventures. I mean, Americans also, you know, was forged as a, you know, in rebellion against an empire. And that's why the U.S. never announces itself as an empire.
The Pentagon's top leaders are therefore scrambling for new methods to find new recruits to fill out the ranks. However, the long drought for military recruiting does not appear to be shrinking in the very near future at all. Now, with only a short time remaining in the fiscal year, how is the U.S. Army's recruitment crisis panning out, considering the fact it's just met 40% of its recruitment goals?
Well, so I think it's pretty clear that there's a clear divide in the ruling class in America, with some more realistic elements of the defense system trying to make it clear that the U.S. is not equipped for a war, particularly a ground war. For example, retired Army colonel and former advisor to Secretary of Defense Douglas MacGregor is ringing the alarm bell for months that the U.S. Army doesn't have the numbers, the training, nor the equipment to be prepared for a war. So, you know, I think it's becoming clear that the U.S. Army isn't going to be able to meet their goal. It's going to become clear in more and more ways that we are not equipped for any sort of all-out war. We're going to have to readjust our expectations of our military, and the government will need to stop writing checks that the military won't be able to cash.
Officially speaking, the U.S. military has been deployed to more than 200 countries and territories within the past 7 years. From South Korea, Japan, Vietnam, and West Germany in the earlier days, to Bahrain, Qatar, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, the forces have been covering vast time zones to advance U.S. interests in different regions.
While I am an American and I don't have intimate knowledge of how other nations view the U.S. military, I think it would likely depend on that country's relation to the U.S. and the international order. Because as we can see right now in the NATO and U.S. proxy war against Russia and Ukraine, many European nations seem to see the U.S. military as the defense force for the West, or at least the U.S. military funding. But on the other hand, if for much of the world, most of the world, who's not the direct ally of the U.S. and not European, I would view the presence of U.S. troops and the threat that the U.S. Army could come to your country as a constant threat and reminder that the U.S. does not hesitate to pursue regime change or other types of operations in their countries.
What implications does erosion of trust and interest in the U.S. military have for the American nation?
Well, I think there's a lot of anger in the country at the way the country had been governed. You know, the country had been misgoverned for at least two or three decades. I mean, since the War on Terror started, you know, the U.S. government had invested trillions of dollars in military and wars that have not yielded any positive results for almost anybody. So there's a lot of anger towards the government, toward the elites in Washington.
An increasing number of young men and women are disqualified to join military ranks over obesity, drug use, or criminal records. Indeed, only 23% of Americans aged 17 to 24 are qualified to serve without a waiver to join, down from 29% in recent years.
Only about 30% of young Americans qualify for the military due to their health, mental health, drug use, or if they have a legal history.
And public attitudes are also changing dramatically against the pursuit of a profession in the military sector, not much to anyone's surprise. The emotional and psychological problems caused by serving in the military are among factors shifting the public opinion about a job in the U.S. military.
Well, the government invests billions of dollars every year in public relations to create a kind of cult of the military. And there's an office in the Pentagon devoted to Hollywood and to ensuring that scripts, you know, valorize the U.S. military and glorify the military. And that's a very powerful propaganda tool because it's insidious. People go to the movies for entertainment. They don't think they're watching propaganda or political film, but really they are being, in a sense, conditioned and brainwashed to valorize the military. So that does have an impact. And they invest millions of dollars in recruitment in high schools and also in video games that kind of condition and indoctrinate youth.
Parents usually encourage their children to go to college before selecting any career, particularly in the Army, contributing to the recruitment stumbles even further. It is becoming increasingly difficult for top military leaders to change the minds of the parents who work hard all their lives and have a dream of seeing their kids in college and consequently in respectable positions.
Well, I think it shows that Americans are starting to see the distinction between the U.S. empire and military apparatus and the real United States where we live and work. The empire has provided Americans with some temporal benefits as our economy profits off the exploitation of other countries. But ultimately, it has created an inflated bureaucracy that isn't helping out the American people at this point in time, as we can see when we're sending millions and billions to Ukraine, to Israel, while we don't even have health care at home.
A U.S. Army study in 2021 found that 75% of Americans aged 16 to 28 know little or nothing about how the Army works, showing an erosion of trust, not just in the Army, but in all of American institutions. How do foreign nations perceive the U.S. Army's role in the international order, considering the atrocities that soldiers and military contractors have committed?
The U.S. has, really had a shameful record over the past two generation. Well, certainly, I mean, I think in the Vietnam era, you know, I think in those years, the U.S. military developed a horrible reputation because incidents like the My Lai massacre were exposed before most of the world how the U.S. really behaves when they invade other countries, which is like other invaders, you know, Americans promoted this idea of American exceptionalism, that America was different from other world powers and empires and behaved more civilly. But then that myth was punctured with incidents like the My Lai massacre in Vietnam and then the Abu Ghraib incident in Iraq and, as you say, other atrocities that have been exposed and other morally bankrupt interventions where the pretext behind the war has been shown to be fraudulent.
The U.S. military sector's solution to tackle the recent shortfalls has been to spend even more money to lure young men and women into the Army. Thousands of dollars are being spared to persuade young adults to get enlisted, and even more, cash of up to $35,000 is allocated to recruits in certain sectors where shortfalls are more serious.
Yet, as anti-war sentiments grow across the United States and the rest of the world, recruiting fit soldiers appears to be a grave challenge for the Pentagon. Experiences and memories of war veterans from battlefields in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Vietnam are also playing a key role in dissuading the young generation to pursue a career in the military.
While the U.S. media and government, you know, puts out some constant propaganda to justify our foreign inventions, at this point, it's kind of just putting lipstick on a pig. The American people witnessed the humiliation of America's exit for Afghanistan, of the just catastrophe of the so-called war on terror. You know, it might not be entirely what everyone might not readily admit that the claim of WMDs was a lie, but many, many do realize that and know that they were fooled for many years.
With only over 3 months left in the fiscal year 2022, the U.S. Army has reportedly met just around 40% of its enlisted recruiting mission. That represents a military fiasco in need of urgent attention from the highest-ranking officials. It is not clear yet whether monetary incentives are enough to encourage the youth to consider a military career.
I think the veneer is running more and more thin with recent disasters, and especially as that impacts the U.S. economy more and more, as the price of oil goes up, as the geopolitical landscape shifts, as China supersedes the U.S. economically, many Americans question the policies adopted by their government, and they're demanding change. And if the government doesn't respond in a positive way or constructive way, you're going to see more and more incidents like the January 6th riot, where there are riots on the Capitol and street fights surrounding elections and you know, angry masses who are either descending on the Capitol or turning on each other. So I think it's a dangerous environment right now in the United States.
Now, the U.S. failure to recruit young adults is part of a bigger problem in America, which involves weakening institutions and all the internal sectors, as well as overseas malfunctioning of the U.S. as a superpower. Now, considering U.S. Army's global performance, how much does pursuing a career in the military contribute to the sense of pride and patriotism for Americans as a nation?
Well, I believe that Americans are largely patriotic and exceptionalist toward America and view the U.S. as the superior nation to most. May still believe that we have the most freedom, that we have the best basis of our government. But this patriotism among Americans, I don't think, is any longer rooted in the U.S. Army's recent, especially global performance, especially for young people. I think that older generations, they might still feel pride in what they saw as Cold War victories against communism or totalitarianism. But young people, we've only witnessed the catastrophe of the wars on Iraq and Afghanistan. So the U.S. government and media, they rely on creating our patriotism and pride in our nation and in our military with propaganda.
With war in Ukraine and the U.S. attempts to bolster NATO to take on Russia's influence in the Eastern Europe, the need for a stronger military is felt more than ever in recent times. The reported shortfall in the army, however, could present yet another obstacle for the U.S. military forces to function overseas.
Well, the U.S. has found a way to wage wars kind of on the cheap, you know, relying more on drones and special forces and high-tech, bombing and armaments, or wars by proxy like we see in Ukraine, where the U.S. essentially is a co-belligerent in the war, shipping a huge amount of weaponry to the Ukrainians and providing special forces. But they're not going to send U.S. ground troops. So I think, you know, that's one way to offset the lower recruitment and the lack of support among middle to, middle upper class and upper class people in America are not sending their kids into the military to fight in these wars.
The dark history of the U.S. military's brutality appears to be ultimately portrayed among the masses in the United States. But generally speaking, how is the reputation of U.S. military forces evaluated at home?
I think that those propaganda campaigns like Top Gun, I think they have, they might get some people excited temporarily, but I really think it's fleeting. It's not really a replacement for, a real good foreign policy. But I do think that Americans generally respect and admire those who serve in the military and would be reluctant to identify any individuals, even, officers or generals in the military, as anything but, respectable servants who sacrifice for America, and that the U.S. military is still seen as deserving support. But there is absolutely distrust of the military-industrial complex, politicians who lie to send our kids to war, and war profiteers. I don't think that any of that is out of the view of an ordinary American.
Skilled, relevant, and innovative talents are headed in the opposite direction by applying for jobs in the private sector instead. In the meanwhile, the Pentagon's top leaders have no other solution than enticing the youths by pitching the benefits of enlisting. And now it's time we check in with Abbas Mutarim to see what he has prepared for us this week.
Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. On today's episode, we will take a look at the current state of the U.S. military and, by default, capitalist imperialism. First and foremost, and we must understand that the so-called United States military must be understood as the armed protectors and aggressors of the capitalist imperialist empire. And the American military, it is the biggest threat to humanity. It's the biggest threat that humanity has ever known and is responsible for crimes against humanity and genocidal conditions. It literally has been in a perpetual state of war since it was founded, killing indigenous people and Africans to create the so-called settler country. And since the end of World War II, the so-called United States, they have intervened in 60 plus countries using a variety of tactics, and this doesn't even include clandestine operations that are still classified. It's very clear that America's military, it has blood on its hands, and it is a manifestation of the devil himself. And even though the U.S., it is considered to have one of the strongest militaries in the world, countries like Iraq and Afghanistan have fought back to remove U.S. military colonizers from their land. And countries like Iran and Cuba, they have been under inhumane sanctions and have remained steadfast. And these must be understood as victories against the U.S. military machine. And this must be understood as victory for oppressed people. And it shows us that the U.S. regime, it can and will be defeated. And if we look closely at the USA's most recent big conflict, which is the US/NATO/Ukraine versus Russia war, it shows us that the Western-backed Ukraine is losing to Russia. The results of this war so far show us that a multipolar world is being developed where the capitalist imperialist military regime of the United States is being challenged. We must understand that one of the main functions of the U.S. capitalist imperialist machine is to wage war and make profits, which it undoubtedly has done, as American oil corporations have made billions from this conflict in Ukraine. And U.S. capitalist imperialism, it is also using, one of the tactics is to use genocidal sanctions against countries, which is another form of military warfare, in an attempt to starve countries that wish to be free from imperialism into submission. This is done to keep capitalist imperialism at the top and to make the world subjected to the rules of the so-called American capitalism. And while the USA, they have made massive profits, there's no doubt about that, it has also taken major losses from this warfare, as in many ways, what has happened with sanctions has backfired against good old Uncle Sam. These sanctions are done to keep capitalist imperialism at the top and to make the world subjected to the rules of American capitalism. And while the USA has undoubtedly made massive profits from this war, it has also taken major losses, as in many ways, what has happened with sanctions has backfired against Uncle Sam. And if we look at the so-called American economy, inflation is at an all-time high. It went up 9.1%, which is the biggest yearly increase since 1981. And while, of course, the elites in the capitalist imperialist economy are making massive profits, it can also be said and argued that Russia has been winning this clash with U.S. capitalist imperialism. This materially counteracts the capitalist imperialist goal of complete world domination and control, and it shows us again that a multipolar world is here. And in the face of this development of this new world order, the so-called United States military is in a recruiting crisis and is struggling to meet its quotas. This has led to the U.S. military dropping GED and high school graduation requirements being waived, as well as some other requirements. And people are even denying the large sign-on bonuses of the U.S. military. And this might be seen as a sign of weakening U.S. nationalism and perhaps an emerging anti-war movement that is starting in the belly of the imperialist beast. But whatever happens, it's very clear. It's very clear that a new world order is being birthed as we speak, and it provides hope for oppressed people everywhere suffering from the imperialist beast of the so-called United States of America. But one thing must be for certain is that imperialism itself will not self-destruct. It must be defeated and it must be crushed. We are always our own liberators. This is Power to the People.
I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and make sure to tune in next time when we return with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In the United States, top leaders of the far-right extremist group, the Proud Boys, including its national chairman, Enrique Tarrio, have been charged with seditious conspiracy for plotting to storm the U.S. Capitol to obstruct the certification of Joe Biden's election win over Donald Trump on 6th of January 2021. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled, Proud Boy Leaders Charged with Seditious Conspiracy in 6th of January Riot. In the United States, top leaders of the far-right militia group, the Proud Boys, including its national chairman, Enrique Tarrio, have been charged with seditious conspiracy for plotting to storm the U.S. Capitol to obstruct the certification of Joe Biden's election win over Donald Trump on 6th of January 2021. The move by federal prosecutors to charge Enrique Tarrio and four other Proud Boys leaders with seditious conspiracy, in addition to previous charges of obstructing a congressional proceeding, marks a major development in the criminal investigation into the Capitol attack. In the 33-page indictment unsealed in Washington, D.C. on Monday, the Justice Department said Enrique Tarrio and his co-defendants, Joseph Biggs, Ethan Nordine, and Zachary Rell, and Dominic Pizzola, for months used encrypted messaging apps to stop Joe Biden's certification by force. The new charges against the Proud Boys leadership comes just days before the parallel congressional inquiry into the Capitol attack is scheduled to start televised hearings that are expected to examine, in part, Donald Trump's personal culpability in the events of 6th of January 2021. Seditious conspiracy, which is challenging to prove, requires federal prosecutors to show beyond a reasonable doubt that at least two people agreed to use force to overthrow the government or to interfere with the execution of a United States law. The new indictment is the latest involving seditious conspiracy after the Justice Department filed identical charges earlier this year against top members of the far-right militia group the Oath Keepers, including its founder Stuart Rhodes, over the Capitol attack. A bipartisan U.S. Senate report linked seven deaths to the Capitol attack, which failed to stop certification of Joe Biden's election win. Donald Trump was impeached for inciting an insurrection, but acquitted when enough Senate Republicans stayed loyal to him. In addition, on the seditious conspiracy charges, the Justice Department appeared to indicate that it has learned new information in recent weeks about the Proud Boys' plans ahead of 6th of January 2021 as a result of several significant developments. One of the Proud Boys, who was originally charged with Enrique Tarrio and the other co-defendants for obstructing a congressional proceeding, Charles Donahue, pleaded guilty in April and accepted a plea deal to cooperate with the criminal investigation into the militia group. Meanwhile, though the indictment also identified unindicted co-conspirators, Person 1 is understood to be Jeremy Bertino, and Person 2 is likely to be Aaron Wallen Walkind. Neither of those men have been charged. A third top Proud Boys leader, John Stewart, also remains uncharged. The U.S. government said in the indictment that on 20th of December 2020, Enrique Tarrio created a chat called MOSD Leaders Group, described by Tarrio as a national rally planning committee that included Nordine, Biggs, Rell, and other individuals who were not identified. Through the rest of December, the government said Proud Boys leaders used additional MOSD group chats to plan a trip to Washington, D.C. and communicate to group members that they should go to the Capitol not wearing their familiar black and yellow colors, but travel incognito instead. The government said in the indictment that on 30th and 31st of December 2020, Enrique Tarrio communicated with an individual whose identity is known only to a grand jury, who sent him a nine-page document called 1776 Returns, in reference to the year of the American independence from Britain. It laid out a plan to occupy crucial buildings on 6th of January 2021. The document broadly outlined a plan to reconnoiter and storm crucial government buildings in Washington, D.C. on 6th of January, though not the Capitol building itself, the New York Times reported earlier. Enrique Tarrio is said to have received the 1776 Returns document from one of his girlfriends, who compared the plan to storming the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg, Russia, that sparked the Russian Revolution in 1917, the New York Times reported. The indictment cited a reference to the moment in the new indictment, drawing upon what appeared to be newly uncovered text messages. After the Capitol attack ended, Bertino messaged Enrique Tarrio, 1776, to which Tarrio responded, "The Winter Palace." 3 days before the Capitol attack, a Proud Boy referred to only as Person 3 posted a voice message in the MOSD leaders group that stated the main operating theater should be out in front of the House of Representatives, according to the indictment. That's where the vote is taking place with all of the objections, the person number 3 said, according to the indictment. Planned the operations based around the front entrance to the Capitol building. I strongly recommend you use the National Mall and not Pennsylvania Avenue. The new pieces of evidence in the latest indictment were messages that Bertino sent to Enrique Tarrio after the attack. "You know we made this happen," Bertino said, referring to the implications of obstructing Joe Biden's win. Bertino added, "They have to certify today or it's invalid." Enrique Tarrio was not in Washington, D.C., however, on 6th of January 2021, having been ordered to leave the Capitol by a judge after being arrested the day before for burning a Black Lives Matter banner at a church during a pro-Donald Trump rally in December. But the Justice Department has said that even though Enrique Tarrio was not accused of physically taking part in the breach of the Capitol building, he led the advance planning and remained in contact with other members of the Proud Boys militia during the attack. 11 members of the Oath Keepers militia are also charged with seditious conspiracy. Lawyers for Enrique Tarrio and other 4 Proud Boys leaders have said there is no evidence they conspired to storm the Capitol building and that the MOSD group chants and the acquisitions of tactical gear before 6th of January were measures to protect themselves in case of potential altercations.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. It is true that executive officers are effective, important agents, and they have certain powers. They have opinions about people and about cases. But the judiciary must act independently and not be influenced by their views. This is also one aspect. The other side of the issue is that these same officers sometimes have expert opinions, which are based on their research. These expert opinions should not be ignored. The judiciary should use these expert opinions. whether this is the police force, in the Ministry of Intelligence, or elsewhere. The officers who are present sometimes have professional, expert opinions. Pay attention to their opinions. Another issue is something that the officers often complain to us about. For example, they say that when they object that why hasn't a certain matter been dealt with, they are told that the matter has been dealt with. They are told, we gave it to the judiciary and the judiciary didn't do anything. So they ask the judiciary why they haven't done anything. They are told that a law about this case doesn't exist. But if you do not have a law about this matter, who should write that law? You must write it. Make a bill. Write it. Give it to the Parliament to approve it for you. This should not happen that an officer struggles, makes an effort, does something, and then he comes to the judiciary and is ignored by them due to the negligence of the judiciary or a lack of expertise on the part of the judge in that particular case. In such a situation, his effort will be wasted. So this is the sixth point. A comprehensive approach of the relationship between the judiciary and the officers is needed.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The seventh point I would like to make is the issue of the psychological security of the people. This is a right of the people that I said I would talk about. The people have a right to psychological security. What does psychological security mean? It means every day a rumor, a lie, or a frightening statement should not be spread to people's minds. Only newspapers were doing such things until yesterday. Now the internet is doing this too. Once in a while, every few days, or sometimes every few hours, a rumor, a lie, or something bad is said by a specific person or an unknown person, and this is published on the internet. These statements worry people and ruin their minds. Some people tell a lie, or they spread a rumor. Well, the people will no longer have psychological security in such a situation. One of the duties of the judiciary is to deal with these instances. Of course, I have heard people say that we do not have a law about this. First of all, the existing laws can be used about this. And based on these laws, the related ruling can be reached. But if you do not have a law for a certain situation, quickly make a law. Of course, sometimes the judiciary itself is the source of some of this news. Sometimes a member of the judiciary mentions something about a person or organization, and his statements affect public opinion.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.